Possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and coffee bar.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson and Travis Stanzel. Jason Croft is at the controls. Tomorrow morning in the first hour, we'll have a health topic for you. Throughout the year, we have physicians on the program to talk about different aspects of health care. Sometimes we concentrate on particular parts of the body. And tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll talk about the digestive matters. We'll be talking with Dr. Claudia Nugent. She is a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic. So if your stomach's bothering you, it'll be an opportunity to call in and ask some questions. Then in the second part of the program, the 11 o'clock hour, our guest will be Stephen Strasser. He is a professor of journalism at Rutgers University and also has been an employee of Newsweek in various capacities. He has pulled together a book which brings together in between two covers all of the staff reports of the 9/11 Commission. So we'll be talking about that and, of course, the final report that the Commission released last week. And again, inviting whatever questions people might have. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week, and we always give you the opportunity to call in and ask questions. Well, in this part of Focus 580, we will look back to the most important naval engagement of the ancient world. It took place in the year 480 BC, and it pitted the Greeks against the Persians. The Greeks were heavily outnumbered, their naval fleet, by the armada of the Persians. They met in a narrow strait between the island of Salamis and the Greek mainland. Something like 1,000 ships took part in this battle, and the Greeks won, even though they were seriously outnumbered. And it's one of those battles that people who are interested in military strategy have studied ever since. And one can view it as an important turning point in the history of Western civilization. At least you can make the argument that if the Greeks had lost, that it is very likely the world would be a different place than it is now. At the very least, Greek civilization and culture as we know it might well never have had the opportunity to flower. Our guest in this hour is Barry Strauss. He's professor of classics at Cornell, and he has authored a book that tells the story of this battle, and the book is titled The Battle of Salamis, the naval encounter that saved Greece and Western civilization. It's out fairly recently. It's published by Simon & Schuster, so it should be out there in the bookstore if you're interested. Barry Strauss is professor of history and classics at Cornell and is an authority on ancient warfare. He's joining us this morning from there. We thank the folks there at Cornell University for providing with us with a high-quality connection here, so it will actually sound like he's here with me, but he is, in fact, in Ithaca. As we talk this morning, questions are certainly welcome, and if you'd like to call him, the number is 333-9455. Now, that's for Champaign-Urbana folks, but we do also have a toll-free line. That means that no matter where you might be listening, around Illinois or Indiana, or if you would be happen to be listening over the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line, and that's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Professor Strauss, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Well, we certainly appreciate you giving us some of your time. Maybe the a way to start would be to talk a little bit about geopolitics, at least in this part of the world, at the time. How much of the world at that time was part of the Persian Empire?
The Persian Empire was a huge fact in the 5th century BC. It stretched from what is nowadays the border of India and Pakistan all the way westward to the Aegean Sea, so as far as not only what is today Turkey, but what is today Macedonia, northern Greece. In the south, it included Egypt and parts of what is today Libya. So it was a huge empire, probably encompassing about 20 million people.
Hmm. What the obviously, on the Persian side, they were interested in increasing the size of their empire, and they wanted to add Greece to it. But also, as part of the background to what happened at Salamis, you have to understand that for the Persians, this was something of a grudge match because 10 years earlier, they had suffered a defeat at the hands of the Greeks at Marathon. And there, that's why it is we have marathons.
Yes. Yes, just as the Second World War was in many ways a continuation of the First World War, so the Persian invasion of Greece in 480 BC was a continuation of a Persian invasion that had failed at Marathon in 490, and indeed of a war that went back and forth, stretching back almost 70 years.
Mm. When we come to 490, the time of Salamis, here the king of Persia is Darius. It was his father was Xerxes. I got this backwards.
Just
don't
the opposite.
I see. It was Xerxes. It was Darius in 490. That was Marathon. It was
right.
480 Salamis. This is Xerxes, who is son of Darius.
He's the son of Darius. Okay. Yes, and he. He was a man in his 30s when he came to the throne in 486 when his father died. He had very big sandals to fill, as it were. He had reasons of geopolitics to fight the Greeks, but he also had domestic and indeed personal reasons to want to finish the war that his father had started and had not successfully brought to conclusion.
Yeah, it's very confusing here when you're BC. You have to count backwards.
Yeah, you got to count backwards.
So partly here was politics, but at least in part, it might have been his wanting to demonstrate that he was at least as much of a king, if not more of a king, than his father had been.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's certainly, there is an expectation on the part of Persian monarchs that the king would have a great victory, that he would prove himself.
There were, when we talked about what happened in this naval battle, there were really kind of two wars going on. There was a land war going on at the time. There's a battle on land, and then there was the battle on the sea, which also seemed to pit to within the Greek side. The Athenians and the Spartans. The Spartans wanted to fight on land.
Yes.
The Athenians, led by this man Themistocles, decided he had built up the Greek navy and thought that was the place that they could win. And I guess people also have to remember that at the time Greece was it was this collection of independent city states, and to get everybody on the same page, deciding what they were going to do must have been extremely difficult.
Yes, you're absolutely right. The Greeks were a coalition of city-states, and that means they were also a collection of generals and a collection of egos, each general or admiral having his own pet service and pet idea as to how the battle should be fought, where it should be fought, and what kind of sacrifices the people of his country should make in the war. So an enormous amount of jockeying and negotiating going on even within the Greek side before they fought the Persians.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the fight and land between the Persians and the Spartans.
Well, about a month before the Battle of Salamis, there was this very famous engagement between the Persians and the Spartans at Thermopylae. Thermopylae is in central Greece, about 150 miles north of Athens, and it's a very, very narrow mountain pass where the mountains drop down almost all the way to the sea. And it's there that a small Greek army, total of 8,000 men spearheaded by a mere 300 Spartans. It's there that they wanted to stop the entire Persian army, which probably was about 150,000 men. So a total mismatch between the two sides. But because of the terrain, because it's extremely narrow, and because the Spartans are such good soldiers, and the Greeks in general, the average Greek soldier is much better prepared and better equipped than the average Persian soldier. They're able to hold the Persians off for 3 days until the Persians manage to find a Greek trader who they pay and who shows them a pass through the mountains so that they can make an end run around the Greeks. Greeks hear them coming, but either by plan or by misjudgment, the Spartans stay a few other Greeks, and they fight and die to the last man. It's a heroic, legendary stance of the Greeks at Thermopylae.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Barry Strauss. He's professor of history and classics at Cornell. And he's author of a book that tells the story of the Battle of Salamis. It took place in 480 BC, in which an overmatched Greek navy was victorious against the Persians. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here, so I guess I'll just bring them into the conversation. They're in Indiana on our line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes?
I was wondering, sometime before you disappear this morning, you could say something about the historical importance, if there is any, of Aeschylus, the play The Persians, who had dealt with the battle. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. The battle was in 480 BC, and The Persians is produced 8 years later in 472 BC. Aeschylus is an Athenian. He produces the shows the play to an Athenian audience, and Aeschylus himself took part in the battle. So he knew whereof he spoke. The play is, on the one hand, a bit of patriotic propaganda from the Athenian point of view, but it's a lot more than that. Aeschylus gives us a great deal of useful information about how the battle was fought and what it felt like to be in the battle. So it's a very useful play for historians. Mm.
I think also another important source for you was Herodotus.
Yes. Herodotus, the father of history, some would have it, and others would say the father of lies. He was just about 4 or 5 years old at the time of the battle, but he devoted much of his life to learning about the war between the Greeks and the Persians, to traveling, to interviewing. He is probably the single most important source for what happened in the battle.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Themistocles. This is the man who was the Athenian commander, the man who was responsible for developing the Athenian navy, mm-hmm. who came up with the strategy for defeating the Persians, and probably more than any other single individual was responsible for this victory.
Yes.
What sort of a man was he?
Well, Themistocles was a paradoxical man. He was extremely ambitious. He grew up with one foot in the charmed circle of Athenian aristocracy, but one foot outside of it. And so he always felt that he needed to prove himself to rise to the top. Famous for saying, "I may not know how to play the harp or tune a lyre, but I know how to take an insignificant city and make it great and powerful." Athens was a young democracy. Themistocles prided himself then on being a man of rough and ready and pragmatic ways. And he was also, in addition to being a politician, he was a military man who had a great grasp of strategy. He saw in advance that the navy would be the key to Athens' survival in the war when the Persians came back. He knew that Athens could not defeat Persia at sea and on land, and indeed that the Greeks would have their hands full defeating the Persians on land. And so he is the man who shepherded the Athenians through first spending the money to build the fleet, then learning how to row it and sail it, and then finally deciding that they would take the extraordinary step of evacuating their homeland, scattering to different places in Greece, particularly the island of Salamis, in order to be free of the Persians and force the Persians to fight them in terrain that was difficult for them. The thing about Themistocles, why anyone would think of these as noble and good characteristics and honorable characteristics, he was also a man of extraordinary cunning and extraordinary egotism. And it was only by using this cunning that he was able to trick not only the Persians, but some of the other Greeks, the Spartans, for instance, and the Corinthians, into fighting at Salamis, where they would have preferred not to fight.
Yeah. As you say, there within Greece there was certainly a very strong military tradition. At least there was this very strong tradition of the citizen soldier.
Indeed.
And fighting there with both your feet firmly planted on the ground.
Yes.
Even though at the same time there was a very strong a maritime tradition also in Greece. You know, they were no strangers to the water. But was it a tough sell for Themistocles to persuade the other Greek military commanders that the place to have the fight was not on the land but on the water?
That was a tough sell indeed. As you say, although the Greeks are no strangers to the sea, they preferred to fight as infantrymen, and the infantry had the most prestige. So it was difficult to convince them that the decisive battle would be on the water, but it was also difficult to convince them to fight that battle at Salamis, near Athens, within sight of the Athenian Acropolis. Many of the Greeks and those with the most political clout would have preferred to move the navy further west and further south, closer to Sparta and Corinth, in the southern part of Greece called the Peloponnesus. That would have brought them further to home. It would unfortunately have meant that the struggle to regain Athens was over, that Athens was a write-off. And as Themistocles knew, it would have meant the battle would have been fought on less favorable water. The water at Salamis was the most favorable place for the Greek navy to fight.
Because because it was such close quarters?
Because it was such close quarters. The Persians outnumbered the Greek fleet by about 2-1, and their ships, the best Persian ships, were lighter and faster than the best Greek ships. The Greek ships tended to be heavier and slower. So if they were to fight on the open sea, the fleet that's bigger and that can move more quickly has an advantage. If you're fighting in a crowded space, then it's difficult for the big fleet to get all its ships into place. And with space limited, speed becomes less of an advantage. And in fact, having heavy ships becomes an advantage. Mass becomes an advantage, because in battles that are decided by ramming, the heavier you are, the more damage you can do.
Mm. We should talk, or I should ask you to talk about the ships that took part in this battle. Then these were ships that were powered by oars,
yes,
generally,
yep,
by three rows of rowers. So that's why the ships were called triremes. They
absolutely
had these three rows of oars. And and I'm sure that people will have some image in their mind from movies they'd seen, mm-hmm, or from popular culture about these kinds of ships, and will have this idea that they were rowed by prisoners, by convicts, by slaves, and the fact was that here the Greeks, the rowers on the Greek triremes were all free men.
Yes, or certainly most of them were free men. There might have been some slaves here and there to fill in manpower, but these were largely free men representing the citizens of Athens and other city-states, many of whom, as I said, would have preferred to fight on land, thought that this was a little beneath their dignity, and yet they knew that it was these ships that were going to decide their destiny. And so in these wooden ships, not very big, 170 rowers crammed in three levels on a ship that was about 130 feet long and only about 18 feet wide, you had all these men, and it is their exertions at the oars that were going to prove decisive.
Yeah. These ships did carry a few soldiers, well, Marines. I guess that's what we call soldiers who fight on ships, Marines.
Yep.
They had,
yep,
some Marines. But
yep,
but the fighting soldiers that were on the ship, on these triremes, there actually really weren't very many. Of course, the boats were also not very big.
No.
But the primary point of the ships, I think, was not so much that there would be ship-to-ship combat as there was what you were trying to do was to sink as many of your opponent's ships as you could, and you did that by ramming into them.
Exactly, by ramming into them and then immediately withdrawing before they could take their marines and archers. These ships also had archers and attack you. You don't want to fight a deck-to-deck battle if possible, because that's going to increase casualties, particularly when you're fighting the Persians, because the Persians have very good archers, and you don't want to expose yourself to that. So the quicker you can get in and get out, the lower your casualties will be.
Most of this fleet was, there were the ships in the Greek fleet came from different states. Most of them, though, were Athenian.
No, about half of them were Athenians. Right. The Greeks had probably about 370 ships, of which about 200, a little less than 200, probably were Athenians.
Hmm. The overall strategy here was designed by Themistocles, but
yes,
he was not the act. If you want to ask, if you ask the question, who was the guy who really was the commander there in the thick of the fighting? It wasn't him.
Well, Themistocles was not the supreme commander. The supreme commander of the Greek allied fleet was a Spartan named Eurybiades. But as you correctly said, Themistocles was the strategist. He was the one who came up with the plan and did the most to sell the plan. But he, too, would be in the thick of fighting. He was aboard a ship fighting in the battle and taking the risks with everybody else.
Hmm. What do I have this right that Themistocles actually had to engage in a little bit of creative persuasion to persuade the Greeks that they should, first of all, that when they're evacuating the mainland, that they should go to Salamis, and that this stretch, these waters in between the island and the mainland, that's the place to have the fight?
Yes. Themistocles never persuaded his allies to have the fight at Salamis, or rather he did persuade them, and then they changed their mind. They decided to disband the fleet at Salamis and head westward and southward towards the Peloponnesus. And it was only by then tricking the Persians into surrounding the Greeks at night that he forced the Greeks to see that it was impossible for them to flee and they would have to fight whether they liked it or not. It would be as if General Eisenhower had tricked the British and the Canadians and indeed the Americans into launching an invasion of Normandy on D-Day and June 1944, and all those men said, gosh, we're here, I guess we have to fight. It's almost that dramatic.
Hmm. So how now, take us up to the point where the mainland is essentially evacuated. All the Greeks decide that they have to leave, and particularly the Athenians end up on Salamis because that's essentially just right across the water from it's right across the water from the Acropolis.
Absolutely.
Isn't there, right?
Absolutely. Salamis is an island off the coast of Athens. And Themistocles persuades the Athenians, Athens is a democracy, and he persuades them in their popular assembly that their strategy should be to evacuate Athens, to send the women and children further afield to the island of Aegina and to the the northeastern Peloponnesus, and that the fighting men should all evacuate to Salamis. And of course, they stockpiled food, particularly on Salamis, and water and provisions, and that's where they plan to have their fleet. Now, this is a very tough sell, because to get all these people, over 100,000 men, women, and children, to evacuate, particularly in a traditional agricultural society, the only way Themistocles was able to do it was to get the help of the Delphic Oracle and to use other religious institutions, such as the priestess of Athena and the Acropolis. He had to get them on his side to say that the gods were in favor of this. The gods were abandoning the land of Athens, and they wanted the Athenians, the Oracle of Delphi said, to hide behind the wooden walls. Themistocles says these wooden walls mean the ships. And Delphi specifically talked about a fight at Salamis. So clearly Themistocles was letting the priests of Apollo know what he had in mind and how he thought Athens could be saved.
Yeah, the Delphic Oracle apparently said something to the effect that there would be a lot of death on Salamis, and
yes.
That Themistocles said, well, of course, we're talking here about the Persians. It's not
right.
The Greeks that are going
yes.
to die. It's the Persians that are going to die.
The Delphic Oracle kept its reputation for accuracy by speaking in a Delphic manner, by covering itself, by saying, for instance, if you cross the river, a great empire will fall. Well, which empire? Doesn't say.
Mm-hmm. That's the way it is with oracles.
Yeah, that's how they are.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Barry Strauss, we're talking about the Battle of Salamis. That's the title of his book, and the battle which took place in 480 BC between the navies of Greece and Persia. And questions welcome. I think we do have another someone here who would like to get in on the conversation in Urbana on our line one right here. Hello.
Great.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having this program. Mm-hmm. This is so neat. You can it's so neat to learn about these events that occurred that really were just, you know, pivotal in human history. And you can read about Themistocles and that battle in Plutarch in his Lives of the Ancient Greeks and Romans. And you can read about Themistocles, and then I think Thucydides was another guy there.
Yeah, Thucydides was an Athenian, a historian, who lives a little bit after the battle and writes mostly about a later war, the Peloponnesian War, but he does talk a little bit about the legacy of the battle and how it made the Athenians very proud, and also it provided the basis for Athens' empire, which the Athenians go on to develop in the generation after the war. We do learn a little bit about the battle from Thucydides as well, as Plutarch, as you say.
Yeah, that's I love this. This is so neat. You know, I remember before I started reading about this stuff, I remember just from just regular old, you know, history classes or whatever, I had heard about the Battle of Thermopylae. Mm-hmm. I knew that, okay, way back thousands of years ago, there's these battles, and one of them was Thermopylae. That's like one of the only battles if you'd said the word, that it would have said, yeah, that was a battle of the ancient world. But Salamis, I didn't recall hearing about at all until I actually started reading this myself. So what I was wondering was, how do those two battles, or how does Salamis compare specifically against Thermopylae, and just in general against other battles, just in terms of its importance and how much of effect it's thought to have had on the course of events?
Sure. Well, in the Persian invasion of Greece, Thermopylae comes first in August 480. Salamis comes later in September.
You mean in time?
Yes. And Thermopylae is a Greek defeat. The Persians win at Thermopylae. The Greeks cause enormous Persian casualties. But it's a defeat. The Greeks don't stop the Persians. The Persians continue their invasion to Athens. Salamis is a Greek victory. The Greeks conquer the Persian navy. They stop the Persians dead in their tracks. The Persian navy immediately rows back to across the Aegean Sea to Anatolia, what is today Turkey. The Persian army retreats northwards, and Xerxes and many of the soldiers go all the way back again by land. They march by land again back to Anatolia, leaving a portion of the army to winter in central Greece. Now, Salamis is not the last battle of the war, but it's a turning point. I would compare it to the Battle of Gettysburg in our Civil War. Gettysburg is not the final battle in the war, but it's a turning point that takes a war that had been going in one direction and turns it in a different direction.
So do you know why someone who's reading history would hear more about Thermopylae? Maybe it was a more of a lesson. You learn from your failures more than your successes. Or something.
Well, there is that. I can think of a couple of reasons. For one thing, the Thermopylae involves the Spartan army, and the Spartan army always got very good press in antiquity. And even today, if you think of the number of towns and athletic teams that are named for Sparta and the Spartans, there are quite a few. And think of them, the ones named for teams named after the Athenians, not so many, much less. The second thing is that Thermopylae was a land battle. And I think it's always easier to visualize and think about and talk about a land battle than a sea battle, because all of us know what it's like to be on land, but not many people know what it's like to be on the sea. It's a different element, and I think that's part of the story as well.
So it was just the wrong sport.
Yes, just the wrong sport.
All right. Well. Anyway, I just I love this this subject, and it's really interesting. And just thanks a lot for having this program.
All right, sure thing. Thanks for the call. I do think that probably among people who are interested in military history or strategy, they will know Salamis. But that the reason that Thermopylae is remembered is because it's a story of heroism and courage in a losing cause.
Yes. Yes. It is, if you will, the Greek Alamo. Hmm. So people remember it that way.
Yeah. We have someone else to talk with. This is okay. Also in Urbana, line number 2. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Yes.
I've heard of something called Greek fire. I'm wondering, is that anything that has any bearing on what you're talking about today? I think I thought I heard it was like an ancient form of napalm, basically.
Good question, and you're right about Greek fire, but it hadn't been developed yet at the time of the Battle of Salamis. That was something that we don't see until the Byzantine period, which is essentially 1,000 years later.
Oh, okay.
The Persians did have flaming arrows, which they had used in their attack before the battle when they took the Acropolis of Athens. It's possible that flaming arrows were used in the Battle of Salamis as well, and we're not certain about that. But by and large, this is not a battle in which incendiaries play a big role.
Okay, thank you.
All right, you're welcome. Thank you. And again, we'll go to another caller, and this is also Urban on line one. Hello.
Hello. I have a couple of questions. One, given that the Persian army had extended its supply lines to such an extent, would they have been able to maintain an empire on the west side of the Aegean anyway?
Excellent question. And like you, I'm somewhat skeptical about it. I think that it would have been a difficult thing, and they would have had to play a very delicate political game.
Which they were capable of doing.
Well, they were capable of doing it, so I would not say it was impossible. I'd just say it was difficult.
I think you're right.
They certainly had a lot of supply problems at Salamis. I think their supply lines were stretched to the absolute limit and maybe even beyond the limit. They knew that the Navy couldn't stay there very much longer because they simply couldn't feed all those men.
Wasn't their real objective anyway in these wars maintaining the empire on the east coast of the Aegean? The Greeks kept invading that area and making a nuisance of themselves. And that was really the inception of the war, wasn't it?
Yes. The war, as you know, in this period, there were Greeks living on both sides of the Aegean Sea, and the Persians had conquered the eastern side of the Aegean, what is today western Turkey, around 545 BC. But many of the Greeks were restive, and the Athenians had taken part in a revolt against Persia there 20 years earlier, about in 499 BC. And they'd inflicted a humiliating defeat on the Persians, burning part of their provincial capital to the ground. I think it's true that in terms of its inherent value, the eastern side of the Aegean was more valuable to Persia and wealthier than the western side of the Aegean. But I think the Persians felt, quite correctly in my opinion, that their control of the eastern side of the Aegean would be unstable as long as the Greeks on the western side of the Aegean, in Greece proper, as long as those Greeks were free, they had a problem ahead of them on the eastern side of the Aegean.
I have one other question. Would you speak to the effects of the victory in this war on Athens and how they tended to misuse their allies afterward and the effect of that upon later Athenian history?
Yes. Excellent question. I think that the war had good and bad effects on Athens. On the one hand, Athens remained free and democratic, and Athenian culture got an enormous boost from the confidence that came from this victory. But the other side of the coin was that having built a fleet, the Athenians decided to keep a fleet, and having driven the Persians from the Aegean, the Athenians decided that they would move into the vacuum. In effect, within a generation, they replaced the Persian Empire with an empire of their own, and they go on to create that very paradoxical thing, imperial democracy. And this is a very difficult thing for many in the Greek world to bear, but it too, paradoxically, is an oddly fruitful thing because it leads to some of the intellectual turmoil and debates that culminate in the great history of Thucydides, in some of the great plays of the Athenian stage, and indeed in the philosophy of Socrates and Plato. So, very complex and rich legacy of this battle.
The complications are certainly interesting and probably informative for us in rather similar situation, in a sense, that we are the world's superpower today that the Athenians were in the 5th century, and we have to deal with some of the same problems they didn't deal with very well, I suspect.
Indeed, there's no shortage of lessons, analogies, provocative questions that come from studying this case.
Well, I'm enjoying your talk.
All right,
thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. We'll go on again to another caller. This is someone listening in Champaign, and it's line two. Hello.
Yes, hello. I'm appreciating your broadcast very much. I have one question about the assembly of the Athenian fleet. 1,000 ships is a lot of ships to build, and I wondered if you could speak to how they were assembled and what effect their construction had on the economy of the Greek lands at the time.
Excellent question. First, just a small clarification. The 1,000 ships include ships on both sides. The Greek fleet was at its maximum 368 ships. Still, that was a substantial amount of ships to build. The Athenians themselves built 200 ships. It would have employed a lot of people, and it would have required a lot of skilled shipwrights. Not at all impossible that some immigrants came to Athens to build these ships, because Athens had not had a great navy before. And we know that some of the materials needed from the ships were probably imported, perhaps from northern Greece. That's the likeliest place. In Athens, they don't have the right trees, and they don't have the pitch that you would need to build these ships. So it was a very considerable undertaking. The money came from Athens had silver mines, and the money came from a lucky strike of silver that was discovered 3 years before the Battle of Salamis in 483 BC. As this will undoubtedly lead to modern analogies as well, but there were some in Athens who wanted to use this money for a tax cut, in effect, to distribute the wealth of the silver to every Athenian citizen. But Themistocles and his political group said, we don't dare do that, and we need to put it into the defense budget, as it were, and build these ships. And, of course, he prevailed in the end. But we have indications that the Athenians were still building these ships in 480 BC, that they were working down to the wire in order to get ready for the Persians.
So the shipbuilding occurred in a fairly short time.
Yes, but... yes. Here, I think a very good analogy to the United States in World War II, which had to gear up for the war almost overnight. And, you know, at the time of D-Day, the landing craft and the ships were still pouring in. And, you know, it was a last-minute thing being ready for that invasion. So it's not uncommon for great enterprises in military and naval history to be put together very quickly with a lot of pressure and at the last minute.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. We have about 15 minutes left. Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Barry Strauss, professor of history and classics at Cornell. He's an authority on ancient warfare and has written a book about the Battle of Salamis, and that's the title, The Naval Encounter That Saved Greece and Western Civilization, published by Simon & Schuster. I've seen a lot of different numbers, as I've read various shorthand accounts of the battle, seen a lot of different numbers for the ships that either side had, but it looks to me like you could think about it as being roughly, I'd say the Persian fleet outnumbered the Greeks by, what, about 3-1? Something like that?
Well, perhaps originally by about 3-1. I think the Persians had about 1,200 ships to begin with, but they lost an awful lot of their ships in a big storm on the way to Athens. And then they lost other ships in a series of naval engagements in central Greece, not far from Thermopylae, about a month before Salamis. They did get some reinforcements from the new allies they had in Greece, but I calculate that the proportion was probably around 2-1 in Persia's favor at the time of the battle.
Hmm. So they, certainly the Greeks were outnumbered. The Persians ran into a little bit of bad luck, or perhaps you might say the gods were against them, depending on how you want to...
That's how the Greeks thought
about it. I'm sure that is how the Greeks thought about that. And then there was sort of a run-up, a preview of Salamis,
yes,
at Artemisium.
Exactly.
Did Themistocles... Did he already have this idea about that the only way that they would manage to beat the Persians is to get him in tight quarters so it would be difficult, and then also to strike very hard and fast and aggressive? Did he have that idea before, or did at Artemisium, did that sort of say to him, well, yeah, I had this idea, but this actually shows that it can work?
Great question. We're not in a position to be able to answer it with certainty, because we just don't know. But myself, I think he had the idea all along. I think my reason for saying that is first, the Delphic Oracle. The Delphic Oracle talked about Salamis, and it's hard for me to believe that this was a coincidence, that it just talked about Salamis. Secondly, they had to put food and supplies on Salamis in order to spend as much as a day there. They had to be ready in advance. Third, the Greek ships were heavier and then slower than the Persian ships. Now, I think Themistocles knew a lot of this, if not all of this, in advance. I suspect his philosophy was flexible, that if the Greeks could possibly stop the Persians in central Greece, so much the better. But I think that he was prepared all along for it coming down to a battle at Salamis.
Mm-hmm. As we've talked, there was this, he had this idea, Themistocles had this idea that Salamis would be the key, that the naval engagement would be the key, and that there was this argument going on between the Athenians and the Spartans, because mm-hmm. the Spartans said, no, we really think this should be a land battle, in addition to the fact that they had an idea that they wanted to fight closer to home, and yes. they also had this idea that they'd like to have some place to retreat to.
Absolutely.
If they needed to, and once you get yourself on an island, there's no place to go. Apparently,
exactly.
on the side of the Persians, though, there also was some disagreement about how the fight should go, and that there actually apparently were some of the commanders, some of the advisors on that were advising Xerxes thought actually that Salamis was not a good place to have the battle, just for the very reason that it turned out to be to the advantage of the Greeks.
Yes. Xerxes was given advice at the Council of War, Persian Council of War, before the battle. Remarkable person, a woman named Artemisia, queen of Halicarnassus in what is today southwestern Turkey. She is the first female admiral in history, and she advises Xerxes not to fight. She says, the Greeks on Salamis, their coalition is cracking up, they're short of food, don't fight, let their coalition fall apart, and then it's going to be easier for us to march towards the Peloponnesus to defeat them on land, and all Greece will fall into your lap, but don't risk a battle at Salamis.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about that. We have coming into about our last 10 minutes here, mm-hmm. so we want to talk a little bit about the battle itself.
Yeah.
It sounds as if what happened was that the Greeks essentially lured the Persians in and then got them jammed in front of them and in back of them so they couldn't go anywhere.
Yeah. You know, surprise is one of the great force multipliers in military and naval history. And many battles, there are many battles in which surprise is a huge contributor to success and tricking the enemy. And this is a classic case. Themistocles sent one of his slaves, in fact, the teacher of his sons, he sent him on a confidential mission to the Persians on a small boat across the straits, saying the Greek coalition is falling apart. And if you now send your ships to surround us at night, you will be able at dawn to simply fall upon the terrified Greeks and destroy them. And Themistocles and the Athenians will help you. And this was a very successful trick. The Persians went for it, partly because it happened to be mostly true. The Greek coalition was falling apart, and Themistocles in later life proved to be a traitor. Who knows if he wasn't even contemplating treachery on this occasion. Themistocles also knew his enemy very well. He knew that the Persians loved to find a useful traitor on the eve of a battle, and they preferred to break up an enemy coalition by diplomacy rather than having to fight it in battle. In any case, the Persian fleet begins entering the Salamis Straits by night, very difficult thing to do. Tribute to their professionalism that when the dawn comes, a large part, though not all of their fleet, is in the straits, ready to sweep down on the Greeks, only to discover that the Greeks now have gotten into battle order and are prepared not to flee, but to fight a battle. And so the Persians come to this battle surprised, off balance, and also tired, because their ships have been at sea all night, while the Greeks have been on dry land. So the Greeks start out with an advantage.
Mm. In these narrow confines, as I understand it, only some of the Persian ships could get in at a time.
Yes.
And it seemed, though, what happened was that the first wave of ships would go in and the Greeks just made hash out of them. And then the Persians kept sending more ships in after them. You'd think at one point the Persians would say, you know, maybe this is not such a good strategy and we should just get out of here and have a battle someplace else at another time.
I think it's a combination of things that leads to this. First of all, communications in ancient armies and navies are very poor compared to anything in modern times. So it's hard to get the message out. Secondly, there's a traffic jam between those ships who are fleeing and those ships who are going in. Third, Persian Navy is a political institution, and it's a multi-ethnic institution. It's made up of contingents from different subject peoples in the empire. And one of the points of going into a battle is to get your ticket punched, to show that your contingent is willing to fight. And Xerxes, the emperor, is on a throne on the hillside watching the battle. Nobody wants to be in a contingent that turns and flees without at least making a show before the emperor, because they're afraid that they're going to be executed as a result. So that's one of the reasons why, I believe, why the Persian ships continue to go on into this mission, even though when it should have been obvious that they had to turn and flee.
And that is a great story about Xerxes. Apparently, he felt so sure that this was going to be a great Persian victory that they set up a throne for him so that he could watch the battle, and he must have been unhappy about with what he saw.
Yeah. If I could just add a slight gloss on that, he's on that throne to watch the battle, but also to inspire and frighten his men and his sub-commanders. Hmm. He says specifically, we didn't do so well at the Battle of Artemisium because I wasn't there. He was at Thermopylae. I'll be at the Battle of Salamis. They'll see me. I will inspire them to fight and, frankly, terrify them into fighting. And Herodotus tells us it worked. The Persians did fight very bravely, but they didn't win. They didn't maintain good order, and they weren't very shrewd when it came to fleeing when they should have fled.
Hmm. Well, at what point did the Persians decide that they were done for that day, at least?
They decided late in the day when they had no choice. Our sources tell us the battle began shortly after dawn and went to sundown, which would have been dawn was about 7 a.m. and sundown was, I think, about 7:20 in the evening. It's around the time of year of when the days of the equinox. But they kept fighting until the Greeks chased them out of the straits. I mean, and they kept going all day long.
Hmm. And did I have this right that one of the reasons that the casualties were so high on the Persian side is that they essentially, most of the Persians didn't know how to swim?
Yes, the Persians did not know how to swim. Of course, remember that most of the personnel on the Persian fleet was not Persian. Hmm. Persians only provided marines and commanders on their ships. So the mass of the men who were rowers were not Persians. And most of those men undoubtedly did know how to swim, but those Persian marines on every ship, they're in big trouble.
And they were, well, I suppose they were the Persian marines as heavily armored as the Greeks were?
Not as heavily armored as the Greek marines, so they weren't as in danger of being held down by their armor, but A, they don't know how to swim, and B, they're in such close quarters. And there's so many Greeks around them that we are told that the Greeks actually used oars to kill men with, that Greek archers and Greek marines would try to kill the men in the water and prevent the Persians from dog paddling or whatever to safety.
Mm-hmm. And we talked a little bit earlier about Artemisia, who is, as far as we know, the first woman admiral in history. She was commanding one of the ships on the Persian side.
Yes.
She apparently, as the battle was going along, saw which way things were going and decided she would change sides.
Yes. She found herself in a position where one of the Athenian ace pilots was coming right at her to ram her ship, and she couldn't turn to flee because of the traffic jam of Persian ships behind her. So she came up with the brilliant idea of ramming one of her own ships. It would give the Athenian, who wasn't close enough to see who she was, it would give him the impression that she had defected to the Greek side, that she was a ship that defected to the Greeks. So she escaped that way. There were no survivors on the Persian ship she rammed, so the Persians on shore didn't quite see who she had rammed. They only saw that she'd rammed someone, and she became one of the great heroes of the battle from the Persian point of view because they thought she was one of the few Persian ships to ram an enemy. Of course, she hadn't really done that.
So what happened to her?
Great question. We know that after the battle, she goes up in Xerxes' eyes. His esteem for her is boundless. He supposedly exclaimed, "Woe is me, my men have turned into women, and my women have turned into men." He follows her advice about retreating, and he gives her the job of escorting his son back to Greece on her ship. We don't know what happens to her afterwards. The sources don't tell us, but we do learn that her grandson is still running the city of Halicarnassus as the king or dictator two generations later, considering that Athens had replaced Persia as the main power in that part of the world. It's an indication that her cunning and diplomacy and ability to carry out a balancing act, that this was passed down in her family to a later generation.
Yeah. We're just about at the point where we have to finish. Just to go to the subtitle of the book, if the Persians had won, how different would the world be, do you think?
Well, I think one thing that we can be sure of, if the Persians had won, they would have then conquered Greece, and the Athenians and the other Greeks who wanted to be free would have had to flee, as they planned to the Greek colonies in Sicily and southern Italy. They might there have continued some of the cultural achievements of Greece, and they might even have been able to mount a reconquest, but they would never have had this imperial democracy that Athens goes on to have, and so their culture would not have been as rich, and there would not have been the great tension, the great debate about freedom and power that the Greeks engage in this very central part of Western civilization. We would have been deprived of that.
Yeah. Well, it's a great story. I certainly appreciate you giving us some time to talk about it. The Battle of Salamis, that's the book, The Naval Encounter That Saved Greece and Western Civilization, by our guest Barry Strauss. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Barry Strauss is professor of history and classics at Cornell University. And again, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
We also want to say thanks to the folks there at Cornell for helping us with this high-quality audio connection for the program. Our show, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Support for the broadcast also comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine in Urbana. On Wednesday, July 28th, that's today, the Corkscrew is hosting the Shad from Capriol Farms in Indiana for a tasting of wine and goat cheese. The tasting will be held from 6 until 8 in the evening at Persimmon Grocery in downtown Champaign. Tickets are available at the Corkscrew Wine Emporium or by phone. Call 337-7704. And that's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. Much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we're going to talk about women in rock. Women have been writing and performing rock music for decades, but they've yet to really receive the respect they deserve. This afternoon, following the 1 o'clock news, we'll talk with two of the authors of Girls Rock, 50 Years of Women Making Music. That happens this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine. On the Chicago Board of Trade, prices are lower. September wheat, 316 and a half, down 4 and 3 quarters. December, 329 and 3 quarters, down 5 and a quarter.